Hey everyone, welcome back to the 443 Security Simplified. I'm your host, Mark LaLiberty, and joining me today is...
Mr. Corey Too Much Caffeine Knockreiner. I'm a little hyped up today.
I'm all jacked up on Mountain Dew! Ooh,
Code Red Mountain Dew even.
Ooh, look at this guy, he's a real hacker. Bet you're wearing a hoodie too.
Exactly. I need to drink the Mountain Dew that refers to that nostalgic worm. Do you remember? You don't remember Code Red. You're probably still in high school.
I'm aware of Code Red. I did not personally experience it in any way whatsoever. You're correct. I believe I was in like middle school or something. But anyways, on today's episode, we are diving into the latest internet security report from WatchGuard Threat Labs. And man, we got a lot of content to cover. So let's go ahead and, slide on in.
I guess caffeine makes me talk a lot. Of course, what doesn't make me talk a lot?
Caffeine probably has no effect on that whatsoever.
I don't know. I could be like the squirrel on caffeine. I'm already hyped up, but then I just go freaking light speed.
Accurate. All right. So it is just past the end of a quarter. And you know what that means?
April Fool's Day. Oh, wait. No, that's not what you're looking for. All our sales came in for the quarter. Oh, no, that's not it either. What does that mean, Mark?
No. It is time for us to talk about the latest WatchGuard Threat Lab Internet Security Report.
Ooh. Actually, this is a pretty cool one. All jokes aside, I like this
one. Exactly. You know, all the other ones, we hate them, but we like this one.
They'll learn why this one's a little special.
For those who are new listeners to the podcast and maybe haven't been around for the last few years or so, about 4 years ago, we put out our very first internet security report where we took data from WatchGuard Firebox security appliances deployed across the world and compiled the trends and interesting views we saw into a report. And since then, it has grown quite a bit. We've got more than just the original three services we highlighted. Maybe it was only two in that first report. Now we're up to...
Yeah, I think you're right. It was essentially just Gateway Antivirus and IPS for the first one.
Now we're up to three layers of anti-malware, our network attack section with IPS, our DNS firewalling section with DNS Watch, and as Corey hinted at in this quarter, we now have endpoint data thanks to our recent acquisition of Panda Security. So, man, this usually takes us a little bit of time to get through, so I guess we should go ahead and just get rolling.
Yeah, it might be worth mentioning, though, you know, the main reason we do this report, if you've heard this before or read the report, you see this in all kinds of different intros we dream up. But the report, the reason we're following all this threat trends based on stuff our products see and catch, one good thing for Firebox is to customers to know and for endpoint customers to know, all these trends should be being prevented for your products because the only reason we see it is because we're blocking this stuff. But again, the main reason that this report is important to you guys listening isn't just to be scared by how the trends are going up and down, but it's because of just being able to change tactics. The bad guys out there change tactics as time goes on, as certain types of attacks work less, or as things like the pandemic happen, where they have new opportunities to do different things. So just remember, every time we do this, the point of it is not just to share the trends, but to really think about how we should adjust our defenses based on the trends we learn.
Great, great explanation, Mr. Executive. And if you guys want to follow along, you can grab a copy of the report from watchguard.com/security report. But with that, let's go ahead and start with the first section in it, which is the Firebox feed. And like I mentioned, this is where we pull information from multiple security services from our Firebox security appliances that have chosen to opt in to sharing threat intelligence with us. So if you manage your own WatchGuard firewall or you're a partner that manages customers' ones, you have an option under the settings to send device feedback to WatchGuard. And that sends some useful telemetry to product management so they can see what services people are using, which ones might need a little more attention. But also, it means that anytime the device detects and blocks a threat, we get a report from that to the WatchGuard Threat Lab as well. And for the quarter, we had somewhere right around 45,000 fireboxes report into this threat feed, which is still, it's only a small fraction of our actual security appliances that we have deployed out there. I think it's, what is our estimate?
It's getting around 12 or 13. You know, we're probably between 350 to 400,000. It might go up and down some, but So just think, at the best, 400,000 firewalls that are active. We've sold millions, but the ones that are currently active, so whatever 45,000 of that is, but around 11 to 13%.
If you are a WatchGuard customer, please consider opting into this threat feed, though, because basically the more data we get, the more accurate of a picture we can paint for the cyber threat landscape.
And to be real clear, just whenever you people ask for data, I'm sure the people that listen to our podcast are as concerned with privacy as we are. The data we use in our report is just a subset of some of the call home data, but it is totally, we anonymize this. We don't know about what your network looks like. We don't share anything about you. We might know an IP address associated to you, but we never use that other than geolocation. The other data that is in the same set of data we pull from is mostly just call home stuff about licensing and other stuff. So we have I forget the exact page, but you can kind of find it on one of our WatchGuard privacy pages. We actually detail what opt-in looks like, what kind of data you're sharing. And I think you'll find we're very, very, we're sensitive to your privacy sensitivity. You know, we have to follow GDPR and everything else. So we do anonymize this in the report, and there's really little data that would give away any of your security or configuration.
Yep, exactly. So let's go ahead and start with malware, which is the first section of the Firebox feed. And that's split up into detections from three main services on the Firebox. At the front of it is Gateway Antivirus, which is our signature-based anti-malware service, which does a really good job of quickly and efficiently catching known malware, so things that it can detect with signatures or heuristics. But as you'll see, or I guess hear on the podcast in a bit, it doesn't catch everything. Like these days, it's really easy to make evasive malware that can get past signatures. So behind that, we've got a second layer, which is Intelligent AV, and that's backed by a machine learning model, where it can quickly predict whether it thinks a particular file is good or bad, and then block it if it thinks it's bad. And behind that is the third layer, which is APT Blocker, which is our behavioral malware detection engine, where it'll actually send it up into a cloud sandbox, detonate it, look at its behaviors, and make a definitive thumbs up or thumbs down on whether it thinks it's good or bad.
Real small detail, but it only sends it up if it hasn't seen it before, which is good. That just means a lot of the malware, you're probably not the first to see it. So even if it's really brand new, there might be five others that saw it before. So sometimes when we ask the cloud if they've seen it, if we've detonated this before, you can get a response really quickly. So it can be quickly preventative as well.
Exactly.
Depending on how new, unless you literally are that first sacrificial lamb victim.
Which, I mean, man, you gotta...
It does happen with Word files, right? I would say the ones you worry about the most are emails with documents, because those documents, even in the campaign that's being spammed to everyone, each document tends to be a slightly new variant.
Yep, I guess that's fair. So for quarter four of 2020, when we look at the malware trends, it was actually down across the board, or at least down overall. I think it was like a slight 4% dip quarter over quarter in malware volume. But on the flip side, evasive threats, ones caught by APT Blocker, were actually up 11% quarter over quarter. So even though malware continued to trend down, which is something we saw throughout basically all of 2020, which we'll get into in a second of why we think that is, the evasive threats are still going up, which means it's easier for attackers to create these malware payloads that can get past signature-based threats. As for why malware has been down for much of 2020, the answer, at least to us, seems a little obvious. So as people transition to working from home or working remotely instead of the office, the overall volume of traffic in general that went through Firebox security appliances went down. There's less people working in an office, less people connecting out through their office perimeter means that we're going to see less malware on the whole. We'll get into it in a little bit, though. That doesn't necessarily mean less cyber attacks. When we get to the network attack section, you'll see why that is. But still, malware dropping through 2020 kind of makes sense when you look at it in that context. One of the numbers we track every single quarter, though, that we've talked about quite a few times on this podcast is the zero-day malware number. Corey, you want to give him a look into what this quarter's zero-day malware number was and maybe what it is?
Yeah, certainly. I'm sure a lot of listeners know this and are sick of it, but zero-day malware, unlike a zero-day exploit, isn't some brand new software vulnerability no one knows about. Instead, what we're describing there is a piece of newly packed or new malware that has never been touched by a researcher and may not be detected by a signature-based method. You know, there are signatures that try to use more generic rules, but a lot of malware packing and you know, most variants of common Trojans get repacked over and over specifically to try to evade signatures. So to us, zero-day malware is something that signature-based malware detection missed, specifically our own GAV. But the more proactive things Mark was talking about, like APT blocker and intelligent AV, did catch it via detonation, behavioral analysis, or machine learning. So this number has been blowing up, and it's stayed within probably average of 47% and higher. And of course, this quarter, we hit 61.6% of malware got past signature-based detection. The reason we think this is so important is obviously we give customers choice in what malware protection to buy. Our basic security only has the signature-based gateway antivirus. You need total security, our full suite of stuff, to get the more proactive stuff. If you're only using signature-based malware, you're going to be missing that 61.6% of potential threats. And by the way, while we do measure this using our own product, we really strongly believe that this applies to any signature-based versus more proactive-based technologies out there. While, you know, I don't know how many people watch Bill Maher out there, but he always has this thing, I don't know it's a fact, but I know it's true. And this kind of qualifies for that. If you take any off-the-shelf signature-based antivirus versus the more proactive machine learning and behavioral analysis stuff, I think you're going to find something very similar, which is why I think even 5 years ago, it was when Symantec's CEO said signature-based antivirus is dead or something like that.
I like that. I don't know it's a fact, but I know it's true.
Yeah, it's a neat little segment he has on one of his HBO shows.
Cool. One of the other numbers that we track throughout the report, at least for the last year or so now, is the percentage of malware that gets delivered over an encrypted connection. So malware that comes in over a HTTPS connection that the customer's network in this point had to do HTTPS inspection in order to see that payload. And for quarter four of 2020, it was 47% of malware came in over an encrypted connection. Now, that isn't in volume. We have to weight that because, unfortunately, it's not like every single person uses HTTPS inspection. In fact, it's still a pretty small percentage. I think we did some checks and it was, what, like 20%? Is the more recent number?
I think if I remember, 21%, so you're very close. And by the way, even though 21% is a crappy test score, I feel like that's high, Mark. I don't know. We've looked at this before, and I feel like it was in the single digits. And it makes sense, by the way. We think you can enable HTTPS inspection properly and get its benefit, but admittedly, it does take some work with certificates, whether you're having your clients do it from inside out or you're bringing it into servers from outside in. There is work involved, but we still highly encourage it. So I'm happy it's grown from single digits to 21%, but 21% is still kind of a failing grade.
Yeah, and I guess some of the other work tends to come from adding exceptions too. Like you'll run into some, especially desktop applications that use certificate pinning, where it only trusts a single CA certificate to sign connections and anything else it will not allow, period. And there's nothing you can do in terms of importing certificates to fix that. The good news is, so one of the upcoming firmware releases, 12.7 for the Firebox, will actually be able to update the exceptions list in the HTTPS proxy, just like hot swap it, like without any additional firmware updates like it requires right now. So there's some additional work coming in that end too to make it even easier for you guys to deploy it.
And I will say, don't give up on these proxies. Reach out to support. Mark has helped folks before, and there might be like you might easily get some setup where you're using this in front of your Exchange server with OWA, where you have it set up properly and for normal computers, it's all working normally. But then you suddenly connect, say, with a mobile device, and ActiveSync connects differently and something happens. There's usually a reason. Look at your logs. Mark has occasionally found people where there's a certain option in our proxy that's being stripped. And if you simply add that back, or allow it. Tell me if I'm saying this right, Mark. It can fix that sort of issue. So realize it's not just the certs thing. Sometimes it might be a proxy-related header or option you might have to adjust. But the log should give you everything you need to know to figure these out. And we've gotten to work in many situations other than those exceptions like the pinned certs.
Exactly. So let's move on to some specific threats now when it came to malware detections for the quarter. We look at malware in a few different views when it comes to the data. We first take a look at just the top 10 by volume. So this is, it doesn't matter how many networks are receiving it, just what malware detections have the highest counts for the quarter. We also look at what we call the most widespread malware, which it doesn't necessarily care about volume. It cares about how many unique networks, or in this case, unique Firebox appliances, detected each particular threat. And then we also look at just the top five encrypted malware detections, which is back to volume again, but these are ones that come in over a encrypted connection. So the top 10 malware by volume, there's only one new addition this quarter. There's a few interesting things like Mimikatz popped back on it. It seemed like that was a frequenter of the top 10 list for several years, but kind of disappeared for a bit. But password theft is back on the menu again for attackers. That's backed up by a few other common dropper signatures we see.
Oh, without visuals, I highly recommend you check out the report or watch our webinar. But if you have, we've seen Trojans like Harry and Helm D. That may not make sense to you, but they're just kind of remote access Trojans on our top 10 for a long time. Krixos, I always hammered that pronunciation. So a lot of this is the same old stuff, but I think it's most important. Let's talk about the cool one, the new one, the moon, Mark. Probably explain that well. I mean, with the name the moon, it has to be pretty bad.
Exactly.
Is there a safe word to say after bad instead of the one I was thinking about?
Bad butt.
Very cool. There we go.
So funny enough, you mentioned it's got a cool name. The signature itself that caught it was called linux.generic.
That's our fault. We apologize.
Boring as it gets. But when we started investigating the actual payloads, so we have access to the MD5 hash, which lets us go look for actual malware and hunt for the threats, we noticed that the overwhelming majority of detections for the signature were from a known malware botnet called the Moon.
And I know this isn't, you're getting into the moon, but I just wanted to mention that it, even though something like Linux generic sounds generic, it's actually a cool signature. It's designed to catch any malicious Linux script. So it's the type of signature that's not a specific pattern alone. It's probably a rule that looks for signs that are common in malicious Linux scripts. And that's why it can catch a lot of threats. But as Mark just explained, obviously we go back and look at the volumetric hashes that were triggered, and we found this one in particular.
Yep. So this particular threat, the Moon, it's a Trojan targeting IoT devices. And specifically, it goes after consumer-grade network equipment and network-attached storage, or NAS devices.
I wonder what operating systems these consumer devices must use.
Linux. History. You are correct.
Oh, wow.
There's a reason it's not called Windows.generic.
Windows CE.generic. I wonder what poor fool has an IoT device that has Windows CE embedded.
I'm sure we have at least one listener from a hospital. Anyways, so this particular thread was compiled against two different architectures, ARM and MIPS, which are different from the traditional like Intel x86 you would see in a Windows computer. I guess ARM is in a Mac now, with the M1 chip.
The M1 chip is the ARM.
Yeah, maybe it's vulnerable to this style of attack then. But anyways,
it doesn't run Linux, so it's definitely not, they'd have to adjust the script a bit, probably.
Correct. So while we were investigating this threat, though, it's not just the payload itself that was super interesting. We actually came across some infrastructure that attackers still had set up. So there was one server, for an example, that had both the ARMs and MIPS compiled versions of it sitting on different ports. But on a different port, it was actually hosting an active exploit against a NAS device. We go over it in more detail in the report. I'll try to do it justice here. But basically, if you were to get tricked into visiting this web server from the management interface of your NAS, like most network attached storage devices have a way for you to log in, access like a web browser on it, sometimes to download new modules or different plugins for it. If they were to phish you or convince you into visiting this site, though, it redirected the web connection. So used a 302 HTTP redirect to then have your web browser load up or query something on the local port. So localhost port 2000, which is the API for these NAS devices, or at least the one it was targeting. And then it sent a very carefully crafted GET request, the URI path in it, which triggered a vulnerability to let it write out a web shell into a web accessible directory on it. So basically, if you got tricked into visiting this page, all with one click, it would write out a web shell onto your NAS device, which then, if it was exposed to the internet, could allow anyone to go in and run any command under the underlying system. Pretty interesting. It was actually really interesting seeing that still up on the server.
Yeah. It's always fun, by the way, to see one threat get to the command and control and actually see a whole bunch of additional stuff that the same threat actor is doing.
It seemed like whoever the threat actor was in this case definitely had a bit of a toolkit built out for going after these network appliances and network routers and stuff. So that one showed up as number 1234567 6 on the list. It was the only new addition for the quarter and the top 10 by volume. If we look at
By the way, the other ones are interesting threats to look at too. We've just mentioned them in many other reports, which means also this podcast. So we're just leaving them out for your sake of time.
Yep. Moving on to the most widespread malware. This one, we look at the top 5 threats for it, and 4 of them were identical to the previous quarter. The newest one, though, the signature trojan.script.1026663, which I'm sure everyone knows exactly what that means, was actually added and predominantly caught Office documents. So many of the payloads we saw were Office documents claiming to be an invoice, where when you open them, typically Office opens them in read-only mode by default, and you have to enable editing. And so the document itself tells you you need to enable editing in order to gain access to this invoice. But if you were to do that, it actually gives the document some additional privileges, which in this case allows it to exploit CVE-2017-1188-2, which is an exploit that we see pop up all the time on both our most widespread and most voluminous malware attacks as well. It's a really common exploit because it's basically, if it gets to run, it can get code execution on the computer as long as the victim hasn't patched their Office installation anytime recently, which unfortunately is more common than you would hope it would be. The majority of these dropped the Agent Tesla Trojan, which we've talked about a few times in various podcasts about the report. Pretty common Trojan these days.
Yeah, it electrifies your entire house.
It actually gives you a Tesla, is what I heard.
Oh, well, an electric Tesla, which makes sense.
Yeah. And most of these came in over HTTPS connections as well. So again, make sure that if you aren't already, you're doing some form of HTTPS inspection, not just for web traffic, but also email traffic as well. It tends to be an easier setup there too, because just the way SMTP works with, more often than not caring a whole lot about certificates. But definitely check that out.
By the way, if we're to finish malware real quickly, the other thing to mention is region. But I would say region was not too interesting this quarter, because if you normalize it, it's not totally one-third, 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 but it's close. By volume, by pure volume of malware, EMEA was the leader. Americas was right behind, and APAC was almost always the end by volume. However, one thing we do is we normalize these numbers based on how many fireboxes are in each region, right? It makes sense. If you have less devices monitoring in one region, you'll see less malware. When we do it that way, EMEA still leads, but APAC is a close second, and Americas is under 30% at 28.2%. But nonetheless, they were all, you know, I'm doing very heavy rounding up and down, but they're close enough to 30s each that, you know, we're not seeing huge regional differentiation once you normalize per firebox.
So let's move on to the network attack section then, which goes over data we get from the intrusion prevention service on the firebox, which is a signature-based IPS engine that catches exploits not just against web apps, so SQL injection, cross-site scripting, those style of vulnerabilities.
How would I know that based on the top 10? My top 10 says web apps are pretty much the only thing we catch.
Exactly.
By the way, it's not true. We catch a lot more.
That is not true.
Web apps are the target.
Yes, we'll get into that in a second. But it also detects exploits against applications that interface over the network, so web browsers, so it can protect your clients.
For instance, standalone Havnium too, for the server stuff, not just web apps, but actually, wait a second, Mark. The Havnium, because it's an OWA, I can't remember what the flaw was. But it is OWA, so it may be web app related. But anyways,
it would be web app. It was an issue in their API, or several issues within their API itself. Wow.
I was going to say we catch specific server-based software flaws too, like the Exchange issues was the point I was trying to make. But technically, I guess it was a web app related.
It's just web apps all the way down is basically where we're at now. But anyways, when it comes to the network attack section, for frequenters of our report and this podcast, you're probably used to us saying that it doesn't really change a whole lot quarter after quarter, mostly because many of these detections come from what we think are automated scans across the internet, which doesn't mean they're like benign. It means if you still have that exposed service and it's not patched or it's vulnerable to one of these, you'll just get popped instantly.
And the other thing it should tell you is, besides the fact that we do suspect bots or automated scans are responsible for a lot of the most volumetric stuff, I do think there is a real theme in web applications being the target. I mean, if you think about it, a lot of the specific network services tend to have, you always expose a website and you always expose email. And because you always expose a website, you probably harden it, so you might have patches up to date. But that's why the web app vulnerability is kind of the bad guy's secret way in. I think if you're a typical IT guy and you just think about the patch level of Apache server, you might not consciously realize that the custom code you've written for a web application or your web developer has written could also be a way to pop that server despite its patching and hardening. So I think personally, that's why most of the attacks we see that are on the network are web-based and they target web applications because that's where a lot of the vulnerability lives. I think while there's certainly people that do forget to patch web servers or email servers, that's a very low minority nowadays. Those tend to be the patches that get high priority. But you might forget that one framework. You might forget a e-commerce web app framework that you bought from some other person to make your custom e-commerce site easier to program so you didn't have to reinvent the wheel. If that framework has a vulnerability, that's the one you have to worry about.
Exactly. And so for the third quarter in a row, network attack detections in volume were up again. So despite malware detections being down, largely because less traffic traversing out of the network, we still had a number of organizations that still exposed web apps to the internet. Like especially as your employees moved remotely, you still need to allow them to access internal resources. And if you don't put it behind a VPN, that means you're forwarding traffic inbound to the web server. And which means not only are your employees able to connect to it, but cyber criminals are able to go hammer away at it as well. So it makes sense that we saw these network attacks continuing to trend up throughout all of last year, despite basically everyone moving to working from home. So they were up again. Unique IPS signature detections were also up again for the third quarter in a row. So not only
that, just means the range of vulnerabilities people are using, rather than just picking a few hundred that they're really focusing on, there's a more widespread range of different vulnerabilities bad guys or automated processes are trying.
Exactly. And it doesn't necessarily mean so it was at like 455, I think, unique signatures. That doesn't mean 455 unique attacks. Like it's probably several thousand, because as you'll see, many of these signatures detect a classification of attack, and they probably catch quite a few different versions of it. When it comes to the top 10 network attacks, there were only two new additions, even though they're not super new.
It's hard to call it. They're technically new, but how can you call it new? I mean, if you look at our top 10 for the last few years, you always see a generic signatures to catch SQL injection, cross-site scripting, and directory traversal. The two new signatures are catching SQL injection and cross-site scripting. But if you ever look at our signatures, you'll notice we have SQL injection attempt 33, 36, 7. You know, these are the problem with web application issues is, by the way, IPS is probably not the best way to catch everything. It can catch very generic things, like if you've ever seen me or Mark kind of demonstrate a SQL injection, there are generic enumeration techniques you might use, like or one equals one. And it's very easy to catch that and use that as an indicator of badness. So a lot of our SQL injection are looking for generic techniques that can show up when bad guys are trying to do SQL injection, but they may not catch that very specific flaw in your own custom code. And anyways, that's why we have so many variants of SQL injection signatures, because they're all kind of catching different generic techniques. But honestly, from a high level standpoint, seen SQL injection and directory traversal, which were the two new things, are only new in the actual number. They've been on all our top 10 lists for as long as I can remember anyways.
If you're going to get one takeaway from the network attack section of the report, it's that you still need to secure your web applications against common basic flaws. Like we started last week looking into specific types of vulnerabilities. Like we started last week with cross-site scripting and one of the fixes for it, which is content security policy. We're going to continue doing that over the next few weeks as well, because like these flaws are still out there. They're solved in that there are ways to securely code your web apps to not be vulnerable to them. But that through either ignorance or mistakes, there's still plenty of vulnerable apps out there.
They're solved academically.
Yes.
So that's like saying fixing a patched vulnerability is solved because there's a patch for it. But it doesn't mean that hundreds of thousands of people haven't done the right thing. So
exactly.
Really, the takeaway is go to Open Web Application Security Project, or get your web developers to go there, because the academic solution of this exists. They just need to learn it and implement it.
Yep. So moving
Although
on.
Although I will argue that there's probably, you know, even things like cross-site scripting get deeper and deeper, you know what I mean? So as we find new and interesting ways, we being researchers, to trigger things, you know, there may be updates in web application attacks too.
Exactly. And we're not perfect either. I had someone point out to me that we're missing content security policy headers on sekplicity.org too.
Right after we talked about what they were.
And
lovely.
My defense, though, it is a pain in the butt to get those set up on a hosted WordPress installation. So we're actively working on it, but yes, even we are not perfect up here in our ivory tower.
Yeah.
Moving on, though, the next section, and I guess the final section in the Firebox feed, is where we look at connections to malicious domains that we've detected with DNS Watch, which is our DNS firewalling service. It does a great job of catching everything from potential phishing attempts to malware command and control connections. But we look at three main categories of domains every quarter: malware, phishing, and compromised websites, and pull out the top 10 lists and then go over any new additions to them. Corey, do you want to maybe go over a couple of the new ones from this quarter? Most of them were congregated in the malware domain section. There actually weren't any new phishing ones for the first time in a long time, but still plenty of interesting domains in a few of the other categories.
Yeah, I'll say some of the new ones are, just to give you a domain, don't go to this domain, don't type it into your browser. Something like easywddesigns.com or skyprobar.info. And all of these were various command and control infrastructure, but they were command and control infrastructure that was pushing Gloopta. Am I saying it right again? I do this every time.
Nailed it.
But they were either Ursniff, Gloopta, or one other.
Oh, I'm so sorry. What did you just call me?
Ursniff. Ursniff. All of these are kind of variants of bot/remote access Trojans. And it was essentially command and control infrastructure for those devices. Or I'm sorry, for those botnets to report back in. Some are banking related, some otherwise. For phishing, you know, we had some new ones there too, and compromised sites. I will say one of the interesting things I think is important to mention on the compromised sites is we continue to see these kind of generic, like the new one was top4top.net under compromised site. Remember, the compromised site is a legitimate site, but it's somehow being used or leveraged for bad stuff. And in this case, top4top.net is just one of the many generic file sharing sites you can go to. and it happened to be a file sharing site that didn't do much validation on user uploads. You know, if you get big, like, I don't know, Mega, OneDrive, Dropbox, you probably start scanning for people uploading phishing HTML pages or actual malware executables onto your site, and you prevent it. This one had very little file validation, so you can imagine what bad guys do for it, because it's a legitimate file sharing site. If I put an HTML page there and you go to it, you know, there's a chance that as you download that page, you know, maybe you do it in a way that it renders, and now you have a phishing site that's sitting on a legitimate domain, or it's just a piece of malware sitting on a legitimate domain. So top4.dot was the big compromised one. The phishing ones, I kind of, more of the same sites that are kind of redirecting to typical phishing attacks, often trying to fake some sort of cloud-based Microsoft Office stuff.
One I do
want to share if I missed one. Go ahead.
Well, one I want to highlight from the malware one that isn't new, it's actually been on here for quite some time, is talknowall.com. And the reason I want to highlight it is, if you remember back in early 2018, there was a very prolific botnet that went around called VPN Filter that was targeting routers and other consumer networking equipment.
And by the way, this isn't that malware category of the list.
Talknowall.com was, I believe, the second stage for this malware. So basically, the router got infected, typically just from someone scanning the internet and exploiting a vulnerability in it to set up this dropper. The dropper then called home to talknowall.com, among a few other different backup categories as well, to try and download the second stage to gain persistence, and then finally a third stage to do all the bad stuff. And now, 2 years, almost 3 years after the fact, it's still showing up in the list because there's still infected networking equipment beaconing home. It kind of shows the longevity of some of these threats where, even though we've, like, the infrastructure has been taken down, I think Microsoft was able to take it over with a court order. Even though it's been taken down, that doesn't necessarily mean that these devices are not still infected. Yeah.
In fact, that reminds me, another one on the malware list was actually a domain being used by Emotet. You know, I mentioned Eurysniff and Glooptaba or whatever, but there was an Emotet domain too. And I think, just like Mark said, it's the same situation. If you followed the news or even our own blog, you know that the Emotet infrastructure has been brought down, which is making the actual infection rates literally drop, at least temporarily. But that doesn't stop all the infected current computers from reporting home. I will say the one strange thing there is, according to the authorities, they did try to send a command when they took over the C2 infrastructure that tried to uninstall it. But anyways, it's not uncommon, as Mark said, to still see callbacks to this for folks that still are infected.
Some of the good news, though, if you are a WatchGuard customer, we try to keep an eye on these malware command and control domains as they pop up. And we actually have a team that goes through DNS watch alerts on our end, and we will try and reach out with you to let you know, hey, you've got a computer beaconing home to a known command and control domain. You should take a look at your network, see if you can identify what it is, and get that uninstalled. So we do have a team that goes and investigates this after the fact as well. Anyways, though, that was the end for the Firebox feed. We do give defensive tips in the report. Maybe we can throw like a couple just key takeaways from some of the data we saw. One of them, like, don't get hooked. Basically, phishing emails are still a very common form for malware delivery. A lot of those Office documents, I'd say the overwhelming majority of them, come in as attachments or links to from phishing emails. And phishing domains are still one of the top threats that we had in the report. So make sure your users are trained up on how to spot a phish. Keep an eye out for malicious Office documents specifically, because they seem to be continuously growing in favor as droppers. But just be aware that, I mean, what's the advice we give? Treat everything with skepticism, even if it comes from a trusted source.
And by the way, I'll give you a second level tip there, because to treat everything with skepticism, you want your users not to even open an Office document that's unsolicited and that they don't expect, even from someone they know. But let's be fair, people are sometimes going to open them, because especially if they come from someone in, you know. A second level tip is, it's not always, but in many cases, these Office documents don't actually become malicious until you do an additional action, whether it's a macro, whether it's doing something called enabling editing, or whether it's just enabling outside links. So there's various messages your users might see in an Office document. So do what Mark said. Train your users just to try not to open an Office document they don't expect until they check that it's something they should expect. But also let them know if they open an Office document and it asks for them to say yes to any sort of permissions, they should definitely pause and put on their skeptical hat. That is a sign that they're, you know, yes, maybe your finance guy has created this really cool Excel sheet that does have real macros, but at the very least, put your thinking hat on, because a lot of time that extra interaction is going to make the malicious document able to do its bad stuff.
You know, I'm willing to say that a lot of cybersecurity issues would be solved if people just put their thinking hats on, or maybe just kept them on. Don't yeah. take it off. Just leave your thinking hat on all the time.
Or when you make a mistake, put on the dunce cap and go stand in the corner.
Exactly. Our second tip, we already highlighted this quite a bit, was basically common web app vulnerabilities continue to hit. So don't let your guard down. Make sure that not only are you keeping the applications up to date, but make sure that if you develop them yourself or you contract with someone, they're developed in a secure way too.
And then, yeah, and the frameworks. Sometimes maybe you didn't develop them yourself, but you've added frameworks beyond the web server itself. Those frameworks get patches often too, so make sure to patch the frameworks at least.
Yep. And then finally, secure your IoT with malware like the moon floating around with active exploits and infrastructure still up. When it comes to IoT, make sure you are doing it securely. A lot of these devices, like, it's growing in popularity because they're useful. They provide benefit. Like, as much as we made fun of our smart water cooler at WatchGuard headquarters, like, it was actually,
I loved it.
It was pretty dang handy.
The flavored water's nice. And I'm not a sparkling dude. I want it flat, but some people love sparkling. You could do both.
Even IoT, if someone can be cool. Did brick one of them, allegedly trying to install Minecraft on it, they're still really beneficial. But like, that's one example, but IoT still on the whole has a lot of uses. So it makes sense that you'd want to use it even in your office environment, but you still have to take extra special care in securing these devices. So preferably stick them on their own segmented network. If you do need to allow network access, restrict it to only what is specifically required for it to work. And then also make sure you're monitoring and providing security controls on top of that access too, so that if something slips through, you can catch it.
IPS, IPS, IPS. You know, now, especially with our acquisition, we love endpoint and network security. Both have places and can even work together. But for IoT, network seems to be the winner, mostly because a lot of IoT restricts you from being able to add anything to the endpoint itself.
Exactly. So that was it for the Firebox feed section. Let's move on to the new addition to this quarter, where actually we got to look at the entirety of 2020's data for the endpoint. So thanks to our acquisition of Panda Security back last year, we now have access to a whole bunch of threat intelligence from the endpoint. Traditionally, the malware section of the security report, we see a lot of dropper files and first stages for multi-stage malware, because that's what we catch, and which means we don't always get visibility into what the ultimate payload was. Was it a Trojan? Was it ransomware? Was it a crypto miner? Now, we do get access to that data. So in this report, we broke it out into a few sections. We looked at a few specific categories of malware for the entirety of 2020, since it was our first go at it. First one, I guess we can start with, is ransomware. That's a pretty big one. We've talked about multiple times how ransomware does seem like it's plateaued. It's on the decline, but it's still becoming more targeted. And the data backs it up. So when we look at the unique ransomware variants, it's down from their four-year high of 5,400 and change to about 2,100 and change for the quarter. If we're looking at the really interesting stats for ransomware, though, the one that I thought was most interesting was the overwhelming majority of detections actually came from a family that we first started seeing around 2017 with the advent of WannaCry. So this, it's not a signature, it's a set of behaviors, heuristics, whole bunch of different detection methods, but they detect WannaCry and its variants. So ransom worms, as we call them, or ransomware that can propagate on its own without user interaction. And 64% of the detections we had in 2020 came from this style of ransomware, showing that now that the box has been opened for ransom worms, they're basically here to stay because they work pretty dang well.
Yeah, and one thing I do want to add to this part, just to give you guys the proper realize of the severity of ransomware. Everything we're saying about the decline, whether it's the volume we see happening or the variance, is true. It's technically accurate. But the more and more I keep on seeing some headlines based on a report that talks about this decline, which is technically true, it doesn't really cover the story of the impact. So you know from maybe listening to us that while volume is down, these bad guys aren't sending ransomware as aggressively to every single person or thing they can. They are targeting it. So targeting may mean less volume, but when ransomware hits now, it hits really freaking hard. So these bad guys that have done it, they're not just hoping that a grandma will click a link and get a download of ransomware on one computer. They are targeting a company using other techniques, very advanced techniques, to totally break in and compromise your network. Before they, you know, they're not even installing ransomware at that point. They've gotten into your network. They're doing lateral movement pivoting, grabbing all your data. They're not actually just encrypting your data, which the ransomware will get to. They're exfiltrating all your data out of your organization. Then they're staging the ransomware on not just one computer, but every single thing that they can find. Part of it may have to do with what Mark just said, the kind of ransomware that actually has some automation in being able to propagate. But part is actually actively making sure, as they enumerate your network, they have staged the ransomware without turning it on yet. And by the way, this includes everything from finding your backups. As they sit on your network, they know that the way you recover is using, I don't know, Datto or Veeam or whatever they can find that you're using. And if they can gain access to that, they will pre-delete your backups. And when they turn the ransomware on, they turn it all on at once. So it's not just affecting a few users. It's really putting businesses out, making it so that they can't get to do business. And the main takeaway here is, if you remember that more shotgun or carpet bomb ransomware, the ransoms we were seeing demanded was something like $300 to $500. You know, I still wouldn't want to pay it, but it's not a huge amount. The ransomware today is literally asking for, if not just millions, tens of millions of dollars. So take our technically correct headline of volume and variance being on the decline with a grain of salt, because when you are hit by this attack, it's going to have a very big impact.
Man, this ransomware thing sounds like it really sucks.
Yeah. There's unfortunately too many people out there that we've seen that know this. Definitely something that keeps me up at night.
Yeah, exactly. So the other major threat category we looked at were crypto miners, where specifically unique crypto miner payloads increased this last year. And it makes sense too. Like, they had a really big high back in 2018 following the massive cryptocurrency boom in December of 2017. With cryptocurrency volume and prices and trading all going up throughout last year, it made sense that it would rise. And I would go ahead and bet that in this upcoming year, in 2021, we'll see it reach pretty significant highs as well. My favorite section of the endpoint section of the report, though, was where we actually look at where most of these malware infections first started. So when it comes to installing malware or running a fileless attack on a victim's computer or a server, typically the attacker has a bunch of different ways to get in there. It could be they've got an Office document that starts it. Could be they exploit a vulnerability in your browser or a browser extension that lets them gain code execution. Java. Yep. Could be Java.
And maybe even Adobe would be, and then the PDF reader that hooks to your browser so that when you click on a PDF, it doesn't just download, but you actually see it.
Exactly. There's a whole bunch of different ways they can get into your network. But the one by far that grew the most in 2020 was scripts, and specifically fileless malware attacks and living off the land attacks. So this is, it could be spawned by an Office document. It could be a script attached to an email. It could be anything that ultimately results in a PowerShell exploit or a JavaScript loader or something. They can go out and grab malware from the internet, all within memory, download it, inject it into another process or inject it into a memory location, and then execute it from there, all without ever touching the hard drive itself. And in 2020, these fileless attacks using scripts rose 888% from the previous year. It's absolutely insane. We had to use a logarithmic scale to show the bar graph for this, just because when we use the linear scale, yeah, it's like a giant red bar for scripts and like tiny, tiny, tiny little bars for everything else.
But that, I like both. I mean, if you watch our webinar of this, which you probably won't do after listening to this because it was a repeat, but we show you the logarithmic one first, just so you can actually see all the colors, but you may not appreciate how big the red lines, we used red, really are. But that linear one, you know, the reason you can't see the other colors when it's linear is because of the scale. It is also interesting, by the way, while clearly it is scripts, which leads to the living off the land or fileless attacks, browsers is the one that does kind of pop up too. So I assume that might be because there's a lot of browser exploit kits out there on the underground, which are just kits that people can sell. It's just if you have a malicious website or one you've compromised, you can throw this kit up and it will automatically, every time a visitor comes, figure out their browser and see if there's any exploits that match it. But yeah, I mean, the main takeaway was the fileless living off the land scripts, a far second, but at least a little more than the other ones were browser clones.
Yeah, so check out the report. We go over to it in a little more detail there. But I guess if we're going to give some tips, like first one is what you just hinted at, keep your browser up to date. So there are still plenty of attacks targeting web browsers and web browser extensions, and the easiest way to defend against them is just installing updates as they come through and keeping an eye on your extensions you install for updates there as well. Attackers are lazy in general. They like to go after easy targets, and people that don't keep their browsers up to date tend to be really easy targets. That doesn't mean you're 100% safe, though. There's still zero-day exploits out there. We talked about a few that North Korea were using to target security researchers specifically, but it does at least lower your chance of getting hit by just doing something as simple as installing security updates. What's another tip we can give them, Corey?
Yeah, I would say for the malicious script delivery, which often does tie to the living off the land or fileless attacks, you know, besides actually being careful of the things you click that might start this, office documents being one of them, you know, again, office documents are a great way to enable that extra content that will run the script. One other piece of advice I would give is EDR, Endpoint Detection and Response. The reason people like the reason attackers like, more specifically, the living off the land or fileless attacks is because they're harder for traditional antivirus and anti-malware to catch. A lot of Windows-based, at least signature-based anti-malware, and even other types of anti-malware, really are heavily paying attention to the files because, for reasons that are obvious, I mean, a bad guy does want to establish some persistence, and that's why they leave a file or they leave a registry entry. But the bad guys have realized that, hey, maybe if I sacrifice a tiny bit of persistence, I can evade all that detection. And that's where EDR products, you know, won't catch 100% of things. But EDR, Endpoint Detection Response, is a type of anti-malware, or maybe anti is a bad word, but it's post-execution malware detection. The preventative anti-malware, like antivirus, is trying to stop it before it even runs. Post-execution EDR is more about knowing that some malware is going to get past your preventative stuff. How do I see if I can find that? So EDR pays attention a lot to processes that are actually running. It can look for things like hooking and other tricks that these bad guys are using with their scripts. It can pay a little attention to when PowerShell runs and how the PowerShell runs and what process. Why is WScript executing this? Or why is the IE browser executing this? So long story short is EDR really pays attention to signs that can give you a better idea of these file attacks.
Exactly. And the last tip would be just don't sleep on ransomware. So even though it has plateaued and volume is down on the whole, like it doesn't make it any less serious of an attack. And it doesn't mean that you're home free. Like you could still get targeted by it, especially if you're exposing services like RDP to the internet. Make sure that you are taking precautions to not only defend against it, but recover from a potential ransomware attack without having to pay the ransom. So, I mean, man, you guys have been listening to us to 50 minutes, but or for 50 minutes. But the last section
of the report... Kind of sucks because this last story is a big deal.
Yeah. The last story or the last section in the report is where we talk about the top security incident for the quarter. And as you might guess, the top security incident in quarter four of 2020 was the SolarWinds breach. We mentioned in the report, it's a pretty gross understatement. It could be argued to be one of the top security incidents for quite some time previously. We go into it in quite a bit of detail in the report, but we'll go ahead and go over it at a bit of a high level here. Now, we already talked about
it. By the way, we could probably skim it very much here because you've heard us. This has been a topic of our podcast before.
Yep. It was our first episode of January when we came back from the holiday break where we talked about it when it was still fresh. But there is still some more info that we were able to cover in the report itself now, several months after the fact. So in the report, you'll see we discussed the two and a half components for the SolarWinds breach. There was the Sunburst malware, which was the actual backdoor hidden in the SolarWinds Orion platform module. One of the interesting takeaways from that was how they managed to keep it hidden while still communicating home to command and control servers. They actually masked it as fake telemetry traffic from the Orion platform, where if you were just looking at it, it looked like an XML file, basically, or an XML data transfer. But the date fields in that actually were specifically encoded so that the server knew which ones were just garbage data and which ones were actually commands or responses back from the server. We talk about Sunspot, which was the specialized malware targeting Microsoft Visual Studio, which is a developer tool that developers use to...
Hard to think of a non-repetitive definition on the fly.
Exactly. Anyways, this was the malware that the threat actors used to insert the Sunburst backdoor. It was really interesting, the steps they took in there to mask their tracks as well, because they were actually able to lie in hiding for several months with this malware deployed on build servers within SolarWinds environment, because it took steps to make sure that if it errored out, if the build built in any way that would have been incompatible with their backdoor, basically anything that could have caused a developer to go take an extra look, it had ways to revert everything and basically mask itself, which is why they were able to stay in hiding right up until and beyond when they removed it from the network sometime in June, well before when these breaches and backdoors were actually discovered. We also talk about Supernova, which was a separate threat actor and a separate attack that was really only discovered because of the additional spotlight on SolarWinds. But it was still a pretty serious attack, where it was a zero-day exploit in the Orion platform, where threat actors were able to deliver a web shell to it to basically gain access and full root on those servers.
Now the difference, though, in that one, by the way, is that the Sunburst issue gave people a way to get into your entire network, let alone the SolarWinds Orion. Supernova, while it leveraged the exploit to add more badness, you actually had to already have elevated access to this Orion device, this SolarWinds Orion platform, which is inside a protected network. So long story short, you would have had to gain elevated network access most typically before you could actually install Supernova, right?
In order to get more badness. Yes. Thank you for using complex words to explain this simple topic.
Trying to simplify. People make fun of me. I can't remember if you said it for Sunspot and Sunburst, but you mentioned the different threat actors. And as we always have to start with, allegedly, but it seems pretty clear that Sunburst and Sunspot seem to be from Russian state-sponsored actors. And many people think Supernova is Chinese state-sponsored actors, if I've not mixed up my state sponsor actors, Mark.
Yep, exactly. And again, we go into this more detail in the report, but I guess we can at least hit some takeaways from the section here, maybe. First being, make sure you're using strong endpoint detection response and endpoint protection. Basically, with these supply chain attacks now, as they're continuing to grow in favor with attackers, you can't just inherently trust applications you install on your workstations and your servers. You need to continuously monitor them so that if they start raising suspicious activity, maybe your notepad.exe starts enumerating your file system and spinning up Windows crypto libraries, at that point, you should raise enough red flags that maybe you got to take an extra look at that and kill the process. Yeah.
And by the way, that probably falls again more in the EDR part than the EPP. And I want to be clear, just because I don't want to overpromise protect. This is a hard one. Like for Sunburst, this is a legitimately signed application. So there's very little chance that any anti-malware person on day one would have ever called the Sunburst installer that started the whole thing bad. But what Mark's essentially saying is hidden within that Sunburst installer was a malicious DLLs that weren't supposed to be there in the first place. And those got through because they were legitimately signed, and for 2 weeks they probably didn't even do anything, but eventually they had to do something. So that's where EDR comes in. We might be able to notice process activity. We might be able to notice command and control activity. But again, this was super sophisticated. They hid the command and control activity too. So there's lots of ifs and or buts that we have for things we can and can't see. And very clearly, these threat actors, you know, they weren't only finding a way to get past the EPP, but they were making a lot of their exfiltration and lateral movement very smart and quiet as well.
Yeah,
so use EDR, but this is actually a pretty critical situation.
You're absolutely right. Like the initial attacks got deployed, or the initial bad builds were deployed in March of 2020. And it wasn't until they went after and successfully breached FireEye, a massive cybersecurity firm, in December of that year that they were caught, because FireEye went to go figure out how that attack actually happened. Like it took a very long time for this to get discovered.
And that's why, even despite EDR being a really good layer and something you need, because it's you know, your only way to have a chance for more sophisticated things, in my opinion, you know, this is definitely the reason we believe this is a situation that's going to impact security for a long time. We the supply chain way in is a very good attack tactic by these bad guys. So we have to get creative with how we detect it.
Exactly. As for some other tips, audit your permissions. So be aware of what permissions you give to service accounts and applications, so that if they do get compromised, they don't just have full domain and admin access to your entire network. It takes a bit more work sometimes to set that up correctly. And I know a lot of applications do request, or at least their documentation says, use a domain admin account. But you can typically do some extra work and lock it down to exactly what it's required to use, so that you can at least kind of limit the blast radius if that does become attacked. Corey, you want to knock out maybe a third tip?
Yeah, I guess the other one you might want to do is secure your deployments. You know, at least one of these Supernova relied on that network access we talked about. So, you know, obviously, your typical network access hardening helps, kind of doing anything you can to follow the least privilege principle. Anything you can do to limit access and harden any servers, limit their exposure to only who needs them, not to all of the internet, will help you. You know, I might even say, we talked a bit ago about segmenting IoT. If you have the time to be really secure, there's all kinds of ways you can segment your network. You can segment by department, you can segment by trust level, you can segment by the type of service. You can make sure that your most important data is kind of away from other things. If you think about Supernova Orion, it's this type of, it's a solution that's gathering logs from some of your stuff. So it does get a lot of sensitive information, but it doesn't necessarily have to connect to your finance network directly or your source code directly. So if this your SolarWinds Orion server was separated, that wouldn't have prevented this flaw from happening. They still would get any information that came to the SolarWinds server, but if you're kind of securing it in a separate segment, that deployment, its ability to cross over to your other trusted networks at least could have been hampered by any additional security controls you had between those segments. So, you know, I will admit you can over-segment too. There's every time you segment something, you have to write very clear policies of what is allowed and not allowed. But do realize the more you do that, like if at least SolarWinds Orion was on a DMZ network instead of your trusted, you're adding another roadblock, even if that particular device gets taken over.
Great tip.
And by the way, if you do have to, we say this all the time with RDP and everything else, if you do have to expose access to something, use VPNs. Just try to avoid that all public internet access.
Exactly. So that was the security report. Thank you for listening for an hour and 2 minutes so far. Again, if you want to read the whole thing in its entirety or get the executive overview of it, it's watchguard.com/security report. I guess what's our ending for this one? Just install patches, install EDR and EPP, and segment your dang IoT away from the rest of your network.
I think I just want to end with everything's fine.
Everything's fine.
I say while sipping coffee in my fire.
Nothing's on fire.
Just kidding. You can be fine. Follow these tips. You'll be okay.
Just kidding. Nothing's fine.
We are so... We're confusing every listener.
Hey, everyone. Thanks again for listening. As always, if you enjoyed today's episode, don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe. If you have any questions on today's topics or suggestions for future episode topics, you can reach out to us on Twitter. I'm at @XORRO_. Corey is at @SecAdept. And the both of us are at #The443Podcast. Thanks again for listening, and you will hear from us next week.
And when you're reviewing, don't forget our rating goes to 11. Yeah! Work out!
Too much caffeine.